This is an interview with Malcolm Rex Krause on Wednesday the 25th of November, 2015, at Rex's home in Campbelltown, Adelaide. This interview is part of the Rosebery Agricultural College Oral History Project. Rex is a graduate of Rosebery Agricultural College in 1944 with a Diploma of Agriculture, Diploma number 583. Rex, thank you for making the time today to make yourself available to contribute to the Oral History Bank for the University of Adelaide Archives. Now, let's start with you as a boy in Parma.
Well, I was born in 1924 on a family farm on the Murray Plains between Parma and Manham. It was a mixed farm, mainly cropping with cereals, but we also ran sheep. We had a few cows, we had a few chooks and a few pigs, that sort of thing. So I was introduced to what happened on a farm very early on. I went to the Parma Primary School, which was a one-teacher school of about 30 children at that time. And I was at school during the Depression years of the 1930s. I used to ride my bike to school, almost 4 kilometres each way on a unsealed metal road, but I did that for 6 of the 7 years. I don't think we did it in my first year, but that's 6 years. And over those 6 years, I had the same teacher, right through those 6 years of my primary schooling, and he was a great teacher, and I have a great admiration for his work, a great respect for his work, and he, in a sense, this will come out in a moment, modelled my career, in a sense. Because at the end of my 7 years of primary school, we used to have to do a QC, as it was called those days, qualifying certificate, a day-long examination, and it was based on those results, in which I did fairly well, that my teacher, who, by the way, was Nelson Stott, suggested that I should go on to secondary school. My father, and remember, these farming days were pretty hard going those days, particularly, as I said, it was during the Depression years, and he was keen to have me back home on the farm to help him. All the farming activities were done with horses, and we had, of course, cows to milk and pigs to feed and so on. But Nelson Stott implored my father to let me go on to high school. I had done quite well during my primary school days, and I enjoyed going to school, I really did. And so, with a bit of encouragement from the headmaster at the Birdwood High School, I then went on to Birdwood High School for 3 years, from 1938, 9 and 40. And again, I suppose I performed reasonably well at school, academically. And at the end of another 3 years, same story. My father wanted me home. The high school teachers said, no, you ought to go on. And after lengthy discussions, my father again, conceded. By this time, my younger brother, who was 2 years younger, was, I think, already contemplating coming back home on the farm. And this might have helped my cause somewhat. I'd already been appointed as a junior teacher at Elliston on Eyre Peninsula. Those days you did a year teaching as a junior teacher under some senior teacher and then went on to Teachers Training College and so on. And so it looked as though I might be heading for a teaching career. But at the same time, and now we're talking about January 1941, that I was fortunate in getting what was called a district scholarship those days to Rosewith Agricultural College. I didn't know much about Rosewith Agricultural College, but certainly because it was education in agriculture, it appealed to me immediately. And so my career path changed there and then, and I went to Rosewithy and started there as a first-year student in 1941. Now, bear in mind that these are the war years. Student numbers at Rosewithy in those days were relatively low. I think that in my third year, which is probably the lowest number for ever since the 1930s, we were only at 40 there altogether. I think 17 of us started as first years in 1941. And it was a pretty stiff learning curve for me to go to Rosewithy. I didn't know much about it, but of course in those days, Rosewithy was fully residential. Nearly all the staff were resident on the place as well. We were a little, almost, say, semi-closed community. So I started at Rosewithy. We had a come in a bit earlier. Those days, the academic year at Rosewithy ran parallel to the agricultural year, in a sense. It didn't start till April, and it concluded in February, or the annual speech day was usually the first Friday in March. And then, of course, you had a long vacation through March and early April, and then the new year started. We first years had a come in a bit early to help look after the place. Well, whilst the senior students went on leave, under supervision of a number of employed people who were regulars on the college staff, but there were cows to milk twice a day, there were pigs to feed, and the poultry unit had to be looked after and so on. So I started in it would have been probably March 1941. As I said, a bit of a steep learning curve for me because I'd never lived away from home. It was my first experience of being away from home. But my parents were very supportive of, and they bought me a motorbike to at least go home for weekends. I think we were allowed a weekend off once a month. And so I could ride home to Palmer. There wasn't a regular service for the community between Palmer and Rosewithy. You'd have to go by bus to Adelaide and catch a train up to Rosewithy, which was pretty inconvenient. So they got me this motorbike, and I used that extensively in my first year. Just as a matter of interest, that motorbike, it was a Triumph, 2¾ Triumph, I believe. It was a second-hand bike they bought locally, but in very good condition. And at the end of my first year, the army said, "We want your motorbike." So they commandeered my bike. They paid me for it at a reasonable going rate at the time. I don't recall the amount, but that's by the by. And so I was out. That was the end of my transport for the next few years. But it was, even those days, you know, it was war years. There was petrol rationing. There was clothes rationing and that sort of thing, we were living pretty frugally. And just to finish my story about the motorbike, because at the end of the war, they rang me and said, "Do you want your motorbike back?" And I said, "Well, yes, I would be interested in having it back. It was a good motorbike." So they sold it back to me at a reasonable price again, as I recall, but it had been painted khaki, hadn't it? And just how far afield that bike had been in the intervening years, from end of 41 through to about 46, I don't know, but I did have my motorbike back and I rode it for a number of years after that. Anyhow, coming back to Roseworthy, in that first year, yes, it was pretty hard going because numbers were down, and the senior students weren't all that friendly in welcoming new students to the college. Again, a learning curve for me. And we had our various functions during the course of the year, which lasted far too long, I felt, those days, but that was commonplace and accepted, I guess, at that time. I recall the annual steeplechase where the seniors ran a the seniors organised it, but the juniors ran a cross-country, which they were sold to syndicates of senior students and trained accordingly, and they even wrote a book, which of course was completely illegal, but it happened. I can just recall one incident when, in my second year actually, when the steeplechase was run, and the new lot of first years had following behind, the year behind me had come in. There was a preliminary where they used to handicap them, and whether some of them ran dead in these preliminary runs, I'm not sure, but in that particular year, there was a little known student from Tasmania. He looked an unlikely athletic type, and therefore the books run by three third years bet great long odds about this fellow, and he was the limit man when the handicaps were on the basis of time, not distance, you know. The limit man would go and 20 seconds later the next one would go, and 45 seconds later the next would go, and so on. And the back marker probably would start at 2 or 3 minutes after the front one, the limit man. Anyhow, Max Clark was the limit man. The books bet all sorts of odds, even up to 100 to 1, I thought, if I remember rightly. And what happened? Max Clark left and nobody ever saw him again. The rest of the field didn't ever catch him. And he won by a long, long way. And of course, the books were embarrassed. The books went broke. But that's the story I'll never forget. This was part of the initiation. And I think that annual steeplechase or cross country went on for some years after that. One other thing I'll just mention is we used to have what they called a blacking night. This was all part of the show too, when first years were called to the gymnasium in their jocks, armed with a tin of Kiwi Black boot polish. And there was a free-for-all in which you had to try and get as much of this black shoe polish rubbed over your next-door neighbour as you possibly could. And if any of them came out looking very white, they were probably got a second dose. And, of course, then when we went to the showers to try and clean up, they turned off the hot water. So that was the blacking night, and I guess how much longer that lasted after my time, I'm not sure, but there are just a couple of things that were part of the initiation that I can remember at Roseworthy.
Rex, you were saying the other day about that, and if you want listeners want more details, they look on page 27 of the 1941 student. There's a Rex and his colleagues wrote a poem about it, so it gives you a bit more detail. It's quite a funny episode.
You don't want me to quote any of that, do you?
Oh, no, it's okay. they can read it.
Because I remember the last verse when it says something, when we're old and decrepit or something, and this now applies to me right at this very time. And I recall that that particular night.
What about some other stuff with, you lived in the main building, and did you get a hard time from students up there?
Yeah, those days, as I said, we were only about, I think, probably 50-odd in my first year. It had dropped down to 40 in my second year. But all accommodation was either upstairs in the main building or in what we call the long corridor, which had about 30 rooms, as I recall, with a passage down the middle and rooms on either side. And the first years always lived upstairs in the main building. Second years, a few of them upstairs and a few of them downstairs, and third years in the corridor. But then usually weren't there enough rooms for the third years, with a few rooms left over for some of the second years. But, yeah, that was... I lived in room four. There were four of us in those, most of those upstairs rooms. I think I had four students in them. Yes, we had regular visits from the senior students. They'd tip us out of bed, and even went to the extreme of throwing our mattresses down the stairway and so on before we could get ourselves back to bed again. The other thing, I guess, about work and lectures those days, and I don't know how long this went on for, but you spent about 50% of your time in lectures and 50% of your time on field activities, whether it was you were rostered to either the farm or to the poultry section.
Now, Rex, you started to talk about the work program on the college. You'd like to talk a bit more about that?
Yes, well, you were rostered to various sections of the college week by week. As I said, if you were A week, well, you worked Monday, Wednesday, Friday. If it was B week, you worked Tuesday, Thursday. I think the weekend was Saturday and Sunday. However, those rostered to the dairy section or the stable section had to start work very early. Up at 5 o'clock, report to the dairy or the stables by 5:30. There was both of these had a supervisor who looked after you when you got there. But if you were rostered to dairy, okay, you had 40 cows to milk. And in my day, when we started, 20 of those were milked by hand and 20 were milked by machine. I think that changed very soon after that, and they were all machine milked. But at that stage, you still milked some by hand. And of course, I'd come from a farming background, and I was milking cows while I was still going to primary school. So that was not a great job for me, not a big transition there. But some of the students had a few things to learn, because they had not had the experience. And I'll just report one thing. This has got nothing to do with the milking, I suppose, but when we came in as first years, it was the end of March, and as I said, we had to sort of, with help from paid hands, we had to carry on the essential services while the senior students were on their long service, on the long vacation through March and early April. And we came in on the 31st of March, it was, and we were rostered to various sections the following day, and Peter Brownwell was in my room in room four, and he'd come direct from St Peter's College, and I don't think it had any rural or farming experience at all. And they said, Peter, you're rostered for dairy duty tomorrow morning. You will get up at 5 o'clock and you'll report at the dairy at 5:30. And he said, you can't kid to me. I know tomorrow morning's April Fool's Day. But unfortunately, they were serious. He had to report. It wasn't an April Fool's joke at all. Anyhow, they were busy days. We had to, as I said, we reported so early. We got the cows milked, and then we didn't go down to breakfast until we finished that, probably around 7:30 rather, and we had our breakfast then and reported back to the dairy by about 9 o'clock. So that was the sort of work routine. For those that were allotted to other sections, well, you started, I think, at 8, and wherever you were, you had to get on with the work that was current for the day, whether it was the poultry section or the sheep section or the vineyard and orchard or whatever.
Well, Rex, what was your what did you enjoy doing the most?
I enjoyed all of it, really. I suppose farming activities would probably be my favourite because I had a background in that area. But farming activities, this is broadacre farming now I'm talking about, where you, in those days, you still ploughed the fields and cultivated them and did the seeding and that sort of thing, and all with horse-drawn power. I'll repeat that it was war years. I think we had one tractor on the college grounds, and that wasn't used a lot because there was fuel rationing and that sort of thing. I think we had 5 8-horse teams that were, in the busy times of seeding and harvest and so on, that were all being used in various fields and so on for various farming activities, and students had to learn how to handle teams of horses. And there was occasional bolts and incidences that I can't recall any one in particular, but, you know, there were times when somebody tried to drive an eight-horse team through a gate that was about 10 feet wide, and there was a bit of commotion and problems when that sort of thing happened. But that was all experience that that the students got those days. Now, here again, I suppose I had an advantage because I think I was driving teams on my home farm before I came to Roseworthy, while I was still at secondary school. Whereas a lot of the other boys, of course, weren't that fortunate and they hadn't had that sort of background. But yes, you learnt how to drive teams of horses, you learnt how to milk cows, you learnt how to shear a sheep and crutch a sheep and that sort of thing. They were common farming activities those days that all the students had to learn. Bear in mind that Roseworthy College started as a training ground for young farmers. And a lot of the students, when they completed their diploma, did in fact either go onto a home, back onto a home farm, or they worked for some farmers who would employ them with the idea that eventually they might own their own property. And I think a lot of that happened. A few students went on into the Department of Agriculture and that sort of thing, but that's where the people with students with a diploma finished up and had careers in various ways, agriculturally related, sometimes not agriculturally related, but they had a good basic training there for 3 years.
Rick, so let's talk a bit about your sporting stuff. You're quite a sports person in your day, captain of cricket, captain of football, champion athlete, that sort of stuff. You must have been pretty good all round at that.
Yeah, well, I was a very keen sportsman, that's true. I was a keen sportsman, and I got very much involved in sporting activities at the college, football and cricket in particular. I wasn't much of a tennis player and I wasn't a swimmer, but I was a bit of an athlete. strangely enough, I had had a had some success at Burwood High School. I think I won the Junior Cup there in my first year and the Senior Cup in my second year. I was a bit of an athlete as well. But at that stage, as a student, I'll come back to that when I talk about my staff days, because I was very much involved in sport those days as well. One other thing you've got down here, meals at Rosemary. Yes, our cook in my student days, I call him a cook, I don't think he was called a chef those days, was Jack Osborne. And he was an ex-league footballer, I reckon with Sturt. And he was quite a identity on the college. He was very popular with the students, and he was the coach of the football team. And I can still see Jack, you know, down there coaching us. He probably still had his white overalls on, and so I'd come straight from the kitchen to give us an hour's coaching, and then he'd be back on his duties back in the kitchen. But Jack Osborne is a name that all students from that era would remember very, very well. Because now the meals, yeah, a bit monotonous, much the same sort of menu from week in, week out. And yes, some of us, I suppose, complained a bit that we would have enjoyed a bit more variation. To this very day, I keep telling my wife I'm not that keen on rhubarb or prunes, because the standard dessert was either rhubarb and custard or prunes and rice. we had them really sort of 6 days out of seven of every week. So, however, we all survived and all did pretty well. But the other thing you've got down here, a word about lectures. Well, lectures those days, very different to what it is today, of course. We had the lecturer up the front lecturing to us. Some lecturers dictated notes, other people, other lecturers handed out summaries and sort of lectured to those summaries, and it was up to the students to fill in the gaps and put in their own notes and that sort of thing. But yes, I think it all went pretty well. As I mentioned, there were even lectures on Saturday mornings for 4 hours. It used to be a 50-hour lecture and then a 10-minute break. And so it went, and they usually went in packets of two. If you had one subject, it would go for 2 hours, two 50-minute lectures. There were four 50-minute lectures before lunch and three 50-minute lectures after lunch. And so lectures for the day finished by 10 to 4.
Rex, from the records, you were a fairly successful student. You won the bronze medal in first year, the silver medal in second year, and the gold medal in third year. So as a student, you were pretty good.
Well, I'll make two comments about that, David. Maybe I was fortunate. Yes, I did get good results academically, but bear in mind the numbers were down. The competition probably wasn't as keen as it would have been a few years later. And in fact, I think the standards for entry were even lowered a bit in during those 4 years to keep at least some sort of numbers coming to Roseworthy. So I was a bit lucky, yeah, but I finished ducks of the year in first, second and third year. But as I said, we were only, I think, seven of us graduated in third year. So there were only six others, weren't there?
I said in the student that you finished with first class honours, and there hadn't been anybody graduating first class honours for a few years, so You still set a high standard for the bar there. That was pretty good.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. But yes, I did finish with first class honours at the end of, and that I suppose takes me to the next stage. I was fortunate in winning a Ridley Memorial Scholarship, I think they were called that time, for which took me to the Adelaide University for 3 years. So it was in those days, and I've often been asked this, had I ever thought of going into the services? This is now in beginning of 44 when we finished. The war was still on. When I was a first year, the third years at the end of 1941, when they finished their exams, the entire year enlisted. In second year, 1942, at the end of that year, I don't know whether the entire year enlisted, but the majority did, I think. And come to our year, when we were down to seven by this time, there were only one or two, I think, enlisted. And in my case, my peers actually encouraged me to go on with my studies. And so that's what I did. And I had a scholarship to go on to university. I spent 3 years doing ag science at the Adelaide University. And before I had finished in 1946, Dr. Callahan, who was still the principal at Roseworthy at that time, had already invited me to apply for a position that was coming up at Roseworthy on the staff. And I went straight from graduating at the end of 1946, and I was on the staff at Roseworthy by February 1947. So it's maybe a bit different to what it would, well, it was a bit different even at that stage, which, well, I'll go lead on to that. By the time I got back onto the staff in 1947, this was only 3 years after I'd graduated, there'd been many changes at Roseworthy. For a start, the war had ended. The student numbers had gone from 40-odd in my third year to over 100 by 1947, and over 40% of them were ex-servicemen. They were either students that had enlisted before they completed their 3 years, or many of them had come to Roseworthy in the hope that they could get a War Service Land Settlement block upon graduation from Roseworthy, and many of them did. At that stage, there was much agricultural land being opened up on Upper South East, the Lower South East, Kangaroo Isle, and various places, and there were blocks being allotted to ex-servicemen. And so a lot of these students that enrolled in 47, 48, perhaps even as late as 49, had visions of getting a War Service Land Settlement, and a lot of them did. And a few of them, as I said, had interrupted their course at Roseworthy. Peter Brownell was a case in point. I think he left at the end of his second year, and then he came back in 47, 48 to complete his third year, that sort of thing. And that happened amongst quite a few of them.
Rex, what was it like for, you talked about the earlier days of initiation, you got these ex-servicemen coming back who are quite mature and war-hardened, and how do things go in the college then with these new sort of, you know, arrangements?
That's a good question, David. I don't know. I think initiation had started to tone down by this time. We had change in staff. Well, Dr. Callahan was still the principal, but he was also the chief executive of the War Service Land Settlement, and so that took him away from the college quite a lot. And so they appointed, for the first time, a deputy principal, and that was Bob McCulloch, who came in 47. He started as deputy principal in 47, the same year as I started back on the staff. So, yes, I think that this was gradually being toned down, and I don't know whether there was any at all in your day, David, when you come to the 1960s, late 60s.
Oh, there was. I think it was a bit more moderated compared to the shoe polish days.
Yeah, so, but I really, it's a good question, because a lot of these ex-servicemen were mature students. They weren't, the normal student had to be 16 before he came to Roseworthy, and had to have certain, I think he had at least his intermediate, and with the science subjects and so on. But a lot of these ex-servicemen would have been in their 20s sort of business when they came to Roseworthy, and I doubt whether they were really involved the same way as the 16-year-olds were. Anyhow, so we're back on the staff, and staff numbers, I would say lecturing staff had almost doubled as well. In my third year, I think we only had about a dozen lecturers, and a few of those were visiting, because some staff were part-time involved in service activities, and by 47, well, I think mine was a new appointment, and I think many others were as well. I think we had more like 20 or approaching 20 lecturing staff at the college then, by the late 40s. Yes, there had been a distinct changeover. I was still living in the single men's quarters at that stage, where I spent 7 years of my life before I was married. And those single quarters are still there, I think, just opposite the chapel, but not used for that purpose. And those days, there must have been about six or eight of us, I think, single fellows who lived in those quarters and had our meals over at the college.
Did you socialise with those other single staff members?
Oh yes. Yeah. These single quarters were a place for all sorts of activities, playing cards and all that sort of thing at night. That's where I learned to play bridge, and perhaps a few other card games as well. We were quite a happy family, yeah.
Were there any restrictions, like you're allowed to come and go on the place?
We staff members could.
Yeah.
It was not for the students. No. The students were kept under fairly regular supervision. You had to get leave. Oh, I'm sure some of them got away with it, but never mind. You had to get leave if you wanted to leave the grounds overnight or go out to something, some function or something like that. And if you, as I said, we were entitled to a weekend leave once a month or something like that. But staff had duties. Now, staff members those days, it was not only were you appointed as a lecturer, but you were... You had certain staff responsibilities. We had a roster every evening from Monday to Friday, when you were rostered from 6 till 10. You supervised the evening meal, and then you hovered around from then until there was always some called it a study period, and some called it a quiet period between about 7:30 and 9. Where at least those students that wanted to study could study and weren't interrupted by some raucous behaviour down the track or radios going full blast or something like that. And that was the responsibility of the staff member rostered for that night. In fact, you went around and ticked a roll. You did a round of the whole of the college accommodation areas and to make sure that everybody was in that should be in. So it was under a certain amount of discipline still those days. Not for we single staff, if we wanted to go off for an evening or something like that, there was no restriction on that at all. But we did have our responsibilities, and also, in addition to our official responsibilities as lecturing staff or whatever. And me personally, well, I got very much involved with the sports side of it. I still, as a single fellow, I still played football and cricket for some years after I was on the staff. And I had the honour, there were two of us, one student and myself, to play in the premiership team of the Gawler Association, Football Association, 3 years running, 1949, 1950 and 1951. We were premiers and we lost the grand final to Gawler South by 5 points in 1952. These are things that you remember many years afterwards. And when I retired from actually playing, I was then became the football manager, I think, for about 10 years from about 1954 to 64. See, we all the sporting activities, and I think I was also chairman of the, what did they call it? The sports union for a number of years, which sort of had the oversight of all the sporting activities on the college, and the blues committee. We used to allot blues and colours to students and so on. So I was very much involved in sport at the college ever, right up till almost the latter years of my sojourn at Roseworthy. One other thing I'd like to say now about my staff years at Roseworthy. Again, all this is a bit fortuitous, and I realise that I was pretty fortunate in many ways. I came onto the staff in 1947 as assistant biologist to Rex Cushell, who was the biologist and also the enologist who was in charge of the wine cellars at that stage. And at that stage, the senior lecturer in agriculture and plant breeder was John Millington, who had come in 47, same year as I started again on the staff. He had replaced Jim Brakewell, who had quite an illustrious career at Roseworthy from the early 30s. He was appointed by Dr. Callaghan as the wheat breeder, and wheat breeding took quite a fillip from that stage. Of course, it had waned a bit because of the war years and so on. But in 47 and 48, the senior lecturer in agriculture and plant breeder was John Millington. He'd come from the West, but he only stayed 2 years and he decided to go back home to the West. So there was, in the meantime, I think Norm McEwen had come as a lecturer, senior lecturer in agriculture, but he wasn't the plant breeder, and they didn't have anybody, get an immediate replacement as the wheat breeder at Roseworthy. Now, I had always taken quite an interest in Jim Brakewell's work. Jim Brakewell, I thought, was an excellent mentor to me in many ways. He was also an excellent lecturer. I think he was very disappointed that he wasn't appointed deputy principal, and I think that was one of the reasons why he may have resigned and went back to Sydney University end of 1946. So Millington replaced him. But then when Millington left at the end of 48, there was no wheat breeder. And because I had a bit of an interest in that area, I was asked to become the caretaker of the wheat breeding program. And that lasted for 2 years, in 49 and 50. And I, of course, inherited a lot of material particularly Jim Brakewell had initiated, I suppose, Millington perhaps a little bit as well. And come 1951, and they still, I can't you would, I guess people can't find this hard to believe today, that they still couldn't find a suitable appointee to take over the wheat breeding program. And so I was appointed as wheat breeder in 1951 and promptly stayed there another 21 years. And that was my sort of background to wheat breeding. But I enjoyed that period immensely, and I'm a man of the fields, and I love my cereals and the wheat particularly. And of course, if I want to add a little bit to that, I had again had the good fortune in 1964, and incidentally, in 1964, by this time, Bob McCulloch had retired or resigned as he'd replaced, that's right, he'd become the principal. Callahan had gone from Roseworthy to become the Director of Agriculture in South Australia, and from there he took a post in America and so on. So Callahan had gone. Bob McCulloch then left, I'm not sure, the date's late 50s, early 60s, and was replaced by Bob Herriot. And after a few years with Bob Herriot, he decided that he ought to have a deputy as well. And I was appointed deputy principal in 1964, which was a great honour to me. I'd been there a long time, but I mean, maybe I didn't have quite the qualifications that some other people might have had. So I knew the place pretty well, but it wasn't long after that that I applied for and was successful in getting a Farah Memorial Scholarship, which was a scholarship. I don't know what's happened to that, whether that's... Anyhow, it was a fund that from which they gave scholarships, 12 monthly scholarships to wheat breeders for study overseas or elsewhere to where they're working in a particular field of their interest that they wanted to enlarge on. And so I applied for this and asked to study under a couple of notable wheat breeders in America. Dr. Orville Vogel, the particular one, who was working on semi-dwarf wheats, which were new in the field of wheat breeding those days. And I was fortunate to be given that scholarship. So I hadn't long been appointed deputy principal, and I was asking for 12 months leave to go go off to America to accept this Farah Memorial Scholarship and study under Orville Vogel at Washington State University in Washington State in America, which the government kindly agreed to. I was given leave with pay, fortunate, I accept. And so I moved with my family. They came at my expense, but I had my fares paid and anything else over there. So, and the government of South Australia were very generous in allowing me leave with pay.
Was that like an academic? Did you actually get a qualification out of that year?
Yeah, yes, it was. Well, initially it was just to study these semi-dwarf wheats, which had become quite a feature of wheat improvement in the Pacific Northwest and down to Mexico, where Simmet were working under Dr. Norman Borlaug. And these wheats had certain features. They were much shorter strawed. I don't know what they call it now. It's a ratio of grain to total dry matter was much higher because they were short strawed. They were all awned varieties, which they claimed was an advantage in photosynthetic activity to swell to swell the grain, or might give you more plump grain and that sort of thing, increase the yields. And they were very responsive to high fertility, to higher levels of fertilizer than. So I went over to study these semi-dwarf wheats. They'd already crept, I think some gene material had already crept into Australia at that stage, but it did really, it changed the face of Australian wheat varieties. If I go back to my breeding days, most of the varieties being bred were not awned, they were awnless, they were fairly tall, medium tall. But bear in mind, in those early days, a lot of that wheat was grown for, was sheaved and chaff for horses and for cattle and that sort of thing. So semi-dwarf wheats changed the scene of Australian wheat. There's no doubt about that. You go out in the fields today and they've all got these semi-dwarf wheat characteristics. They're fairly short-strawed, they're awned, and they respond quite well to additional fertiliser and that sort of thing. And it has really changed the scene. Anyway, to come back to my situation, I was given leave for 12 months to do this extra study with Vogel in at Washington State University. And at the same time, I decided to take a few university subjects which I felt I needed upgrading in, or I hadn't done much of in my lecture commitments back at Rosebery. And again, I suppose I did reasonably well in those subjects that I took, and the people at Washington State encouraged me to convert this to a master's degree, which meant that I had to have my 12-month scholarship extended somewhat. Again, whoever was handling the Farrah Memorial Trust were very kind to me, and they did extend it. And so I finished up being in Washington State for about 19 months, I think, and completed a master's during that time as well. As becoming more familiar with these semi-dwarf wheats, in fact I started a lot of making a lot of crosses between the what was at that stage the commonly grown varieties in South Australia and some of these semi-dwarfs, mainly the Mexican ones, because they were there. Most of the wheat grown around the Pullman area where in Washington State Washington State University is winter wheat, and winter wheat has a completely different habit of growth, whereas the Mexican ones were not winter wheats. They were what do they call the short growing periods, like, well, we've got a what they call spring wheats, but here in Australia we say we grow spring wheats with a spring wheats, but they don't have the. We grow winter wheats with a spring habit. They don't have a period when they are dormant through the winter months, when a lot of the wheat fields in Washington State were covered in snow. Anyhow, that's another story, and I'm getting off the track here a bit, I think.
Well, Rex, you spent a long time at Rosebery as a student, then as a single man, then as a married person. Spent a little bit of time. What was it like as a married family on the college?
Well, I wish my wife could answer that partly, because we had a wonderful time. At those times, there was housing available on the college grounds. There must have been anything up to 20 houses, I guess, where the majority of the staff lived on campus. There would have been a few that didn't, but the majority did. Then you had your bunch of unmarried people as well. But I think the wives would agree that their life at Roseworthy those days was very, very enjoyable. I suppose a lot of us were sort of newly married and so on, had children much the same age, and there were no restrictions. The kids could just about run anywhere over the college grounds, and we as parents felt that they were perfectly safe, and they, you know, got to know one another and made great friends. In some cases, still to this very day, our children still, and the next generation now, are still friends going right back to those days. They went to the Roseworthy Primary School. There used to be a bus run in every morning to get the mail from the railway station anyway. So they went in on this bus and brought back on in the afternoon. A few of them went down to one teacher school down at Kangaroo Flat, but the majority went into Roseworthy, and there was life on the college those days. It was great. I mean, we had it was pretty cheap living. We rented our houses. We were in a housing trust home, with a fairly nominal sort of rent. We could buy our eggs from the poultry unit at a nominal price. We could get our milk from that dairy every week, every day, and usually you put the billy out and you wanted 2 litres and you'd finish up with 4, this sort of thing. You paid for at a very, very nominal rate. We had there were 2 gardeners that used to look after the vegetable garden. I don't know, were the Fairleys still there in your day?
I think they just finished when I started.
Yeah. They had finished, yeah. They worked there for a long time, and Bill Fairley, well, he grew all sorts of vegetables for the college kitchen, but when there was a flush of something, any surplus would go into. We used to have to put our veggie bags out once a week, and once a week we got a ration of vegetables, anything that was surplus from the garden. So we staffed it all right, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There was a lot of, when I think about, I mean, I was there in the late 60s, but things like yourself, you know, Ray Norton, Cliff Hooper, Ken Liske, the staff were very stable. A lot of them were there for a long time. So imagine you build up some good friendships
with those people. That's very true. You should say that, David. Well, I was on the staff for 25 years, from 47 to 72. But I can quote a few others. Ken Leskey started the year after I did. He started in 48, and he spent all his working life there. I don't know when he retired, in the 1990s, I think. He would have been there near 40 years, I would think. Gil Hollenby is another one, talking about the wheat breeders. Gil Hollenby joined me as my assistant in 1961. And that was at a time when, the Wheat Research Act or something went through, and there was a levy placed on grain, farmers delivering grain. And this set up a wheat fund, which was matched by the Commonwealth Government and made funds available for wheat research in various places. Throughout Australia, for that matter. But we were fortunate in getting some of this money, which allowed me to appoint an assistant wheat breeder, and also a seeds officer. We were growing a lot of pure seed at Roseworthy in those days. And I think we also had money for a laboratory assistant for doing certain tests on wheat and so on in our laboratories. But Gil Hollenby joined me as assistant in 1961, and he became the senior wheat breeder in 72 when I left, and he stayed there then till 2002. He was on the staff for 40 years, that's sort of an example of what you said, that staff members those days, a lot of them stayed for a long time. And you mentioned Cliff Hooper, you mentioned Ray Norton. They all had long terms on the, as staff members of the college.
So with, talk about the college life and there for a long time, what amazes me is the when you talk about the routines that you were on the college in the 40s, I started there in the late 60s, and most of them were still intact. So the recipe must have been right in terms of work, lectures, discipline, I don't know, initiation, all those things just seemed to be nothing seemed to change much over the time that you and I were there. So it was amazing how that sort of obviously worked and produced.
Yeah, well, I think probably, David, the big changes came in the 1970s.
Yeah.
See, I left in 72. Harriet was still principal then. You finished in about 71?
End of 71, yeah.
About the same time, or just a bit earlier. Harriet was still principal, and the college was still... Yeah, we'd introduced the RDAT the fourth year, which you did.
Mm.
Was the Dairy Corps still running then?
No, that had finished. I think in around that time it became a College of Advanced Education. That was a big change.
What I was about to say. It was in the 70s sometime that Roseworthy became part of the Colleges of Advanced Education. That was a transitional period, and for the first time, females were allowed in as students. Were there any girls in
New
York?
No, they started in 74, I think.
74, okay, right. Well, the 70s were quite a change when the Roseworthy became a College of Advanced Education, and from there, of course, it became a campus of the Adelaide University, and completely different. I'll go back to Harriet, of course, as you will remember if you were under his regime, was very, very strict and disciplinarian, and no alcohol on the place. And I wouldn't say that it didn't happen, but he was strict on that. And yet, when Harriet left? In about mid-70s?
Oh, I think it was about 74.
Yeah,
end of 74.
About mid-70s.
I think he retired then.
He retired, that's correct. And Don Williams came in as his replacement. And the year after, they had a wet canteen on the college.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the discipline, I think, changed completely at that stage. But I'd gone by this time, so I can't really comment on anything beyond 72.
Mm.
But I tell you, a fellow who would be interesting for you to interview is Gil Hollenby, because he was there from... And he's... a bit younger than I am, a fair bit younger than I am, and is still very, very much with it mentally. And he, as I said, he was there from 61 to 2002, as far as I know, which is 41 years, I think.
Yep. Well, Rex, look, we might wind it up there, because we've had a really good talk about your time as a student and as a staff member and that sort of thing. And this is all part of the archives, is getting these stories together, because collectively they become a great source of information for other people to think, to ponder on, think about these places in the past. So I thank you again for putting your time aside to talk to us today, because it'll go in the archives, it'll be there forever, and your great-grandchildren will be able to listen to your voice and hear the stories you told about your motorbike. So thanks very much again, and we'll meet you another time.
Well, thank you, David. I enjoyed this, reminiscing, if you like, about what happened in my student days and then through to the staff years. And they were the key years of my career. There's no question about that. And I enjoyed particularly my years on the staff there. And thank you for having me.
Okay,
I hope it's going to be all right.
Thanks, Rex. Okay, in conclusion, this is the interview with Rex Krause by David Spencer in relation to the Roseville Agricultural College project.